From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am honored and I am humbled that you have chosen me as your candidate to be president. You have my solemn promise that I will only act in the best interests of our country. This is your country. I will be your servant.
The Reform Party nominates billionaire H. Ross Perot for president. Republicans invoke Martin Luther King repeatedly throughout the convention.
Dr. King said, "I don't know what the future holds, but I do know who holds the future." God bless you. God bless America.
Has Dr. King's name been used in vain? And Border Patrol agents allege Operation Gatekeeper is a fraud. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton turns 50 today. He and Texas billionaire Ross Perot seized the presidential campaign spotlight yesterday after a week of headlines dominated by Republican nominee Bob Dole. The Reform Party nominated Perot for president in Valley Forge, and President Clinton was the guest of honor at a star-studded birthday celebration in New York that doubled as a political fundraiser. He raised $10 million. Outside the event, more than 1,000 protesters blasted Clinton's intention to sign the welfare bill. Several protesters got inside, shouting shame. Another made it inside to his private party. She was Workers' World Party presidential candidate Monica Moorhead.
Another campaign organizer, myself, were able to get into the Sheraton Hotel, where a private gathering was taking place to celebrate Clinton's 50th birthday. And we were able to get tickets, and we were able to get right in front of the president of the United States and confront him with our signs that said welfare cuts will put 1 million more children into poverty.
And the abortion issue, virtually a non-subject once the Republican National Convention began last week, made its reappearance on the campaign trail yesterday, 3 days into the presidential campaign. Republican vice presidential nominee Jack Kemp got several thousand supporters in Pittsburgh booing when he attacked President Clinton's veto of a bill prohibiting late-term abortions, saying it was not a fit thing for a shining city on a hill, Ronald Reagan's term for a civilized society, to do. But presidential nominee Bob Dole did not follow Kemp's lead at a rally in a park, zeroing in on instead how he wants to give every American, including President Clinton, a tax cut. To do it in Clinton's case, he said, he would have to beat the president in November. Dole said both men had planned to raise the issue at a Polish Pulaski Day parade in Buffalo earlier in the day, but did not get a chance to do so because of scheduling problems. And House Speaker Newt Gingrich accused Democrats yesterday of trying to demonize him and said the Democratic Party has become sort of an anti-Newt party in trying to reelect President Clinton. With Gingrich registering low approval ratings in numerous polls, Democrats for months have sought to link GOP presidential nominee Bob Dole with the combative Georgia Republican, referring frequently to the Dole-Gingrich Republican agenda. And this news in Newsweek this week about U.S. Senator Carol Mosley Braun. Last week, the Illinois Democrat, the only African-American in the U.S. Senate, made a four-day private visit to Nigeria. She passed up meeting with pro-democracy leaders in Lagos and instead sipped tea with Abacha's wife. That's the Nigerian military dictator, Sonny Abacha. She also traveled with a military escort through Ogoni Land, the oil-rich home of playwright Ken Sarawiwa, whose hanging last year provoked international protests. Nigerian state radio reported that she praised the local military governor who oversaw the hanging for bringing peace in the region. Nigerian dissidents were appalled. They said, "We expect that democratic forces should be on our side." And you're listening to Democracy Now! Ross Perot easily won the presidential nomination of his Reform Party, which held the second of a two-part convention this weekend in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky was there. He joins us now. Welcome, Larry.
Hello again, Amy.
And why don't you tell us, what is the difference between the Valley Forge event, where Ross Perot was nominated, and the convention that was held just 1 week ago in Long Beach, California?
Well, Valley Forge doesn't look much like Long Beach, Amy. Valley Forge, which is praised for its Revolutionary War antecedents and great historical connotations, really is one giant shopping mall now. It's actually the largest mall east of the Mississippi. And in a way, it was an appropriate place for people who are disturbed about materialism and the effects of capitalism to have a convention. Long Beach, the convention center, was on the waterfront. And there, too, although the city is suffering, there's a lot of glitter and gleam around it. I'd say the biggest difference between yesterday's event here in Pennsylvania and the one the week before in Long Beach was the absence of any tension about who was going to get the nomination. As you mentioned, the announcement on Saturday that Ross Perot had won the balloting by a 2-1 margin took any sense of surprise away from what was going to happen. But it also took away from the audience, which was about the same size here in Pennsylvania as it was in California, about 2,000 people. It took away from the audience anybody standing up and waving Lamb signs. In fact, I couldn't find a single Lamb supporter among the several dozen people that I spoke to inside the Senator. But former Governor Lamb was there himself speaking to the crowd. He announced as he began his speech that he was going to continue his passionate commitment to the cause, but he sounded anything but passionate when he addressed the audience.
We have America caught in this very strange catch-22, where the best politics is the worst public policy. But no great nation in history has made their elections into public auctions and remained a great country. What better place than Valley Forge to recognize again that sometimes freedom needs sacrifice? Half a mile away from where we meet tonight, brave soldiers froze at Valley Forge 220 years ago, and the next generation accepted and paid off the debts that they ran up in fighting for our independence. But not my generation. Oh, no. We just kept borrowing and borrowing and borrowing. We add to the nation's debt for programs that we ourselves do not earn. Yet you do not keep a nation great by political action committees, 30-second ads, or ads that negative ads that deliberately mislead the public.
Former Colorado Governor Richard Lamb addressing the Reform Party meeting. It's hard to call it a convention because these were not delegates, although it called itself a convention. These were basically self-selected people. All you had to do to go to this meeting was show up. There was no admission charge. There were seats set up. There was even what they called an old-fashioned political rally throughout the afternoon downstairs. And I guess if an old-fashioned political rally is something where you pay for your own hot dogs, and this was your old-fashioned political rally.
Larry, I thought one of the interesting comments that Dick Lamb made last night in a speech was about immigration, and we all know that he's quite extreme on the issue of immigration when he said, if the bathtub is overflowing, you turn off the spigot.
Yeah, he begged the party to put immigration into its platform, and he was actually, I suppose, urging Ross Perot to mention it in his speech, but Ross Perot didn't. And as to how the Reform Party platform actually gets formed, that's kind of a mysterious process, since, in fact, as we'll talk about in a minute, there really is no such thing as the Reform Party right now. It's just a name, has no legal status. When Ross Perot got his turn to speak, he was his usual energetic self, but he gave essentially the same speech, almost word for word, that he gave in Long Beach a week ago, including using the same charts, visual aids that he always uses in his speech. And he was quite vitriolic, as usual, about the establishment, and he gave a hint, I think, that we're going to see the rhetoric of this campaign fought out on the ground the Republicans want it fought out on, which is the ground of taxes, largely. Ross Perot.
Now, all the political experts across the country watching this program will be shocked and are shocked already that I am talking about real problems and the fact that we have to face them and solve them in an acceptance speech. This is supposed to be morning in America. You're supposed to leave feeling giddy and good because I just whistled good news all night. That's not what we're about. We're about getting the facts, taking action, producing results. I want you all to know, the only reason I do this and the only reason I ask my family to go through all this unpleasantness, unfortunately, that goes with politics, is that I am absolutely devoted to solving these problems. We got a new book out on the dollar crisis. Senator Paul Simon and I wrote it. It's got a lot of detail about all these issues we've been talking about. I hope you'll read it. Get the facts. And we must have a new tax system. We know that. The first step in solving any problem is to define the problem. Watch my lips, Washington. If you want to solve a problem, carefully, thoughtfully, and rationally define it. Well, one of the things to do is look at history. You ain't going to believe this one. Before our nation was formed, the total cost to run our government was 67 cents per person a year. Then after our nation was formed, it went up to a dollar a year. Then, 120 years later, in 1910, it was up to $6.75 per person a year. Now we're getting to be a pretty big nation, right? $6.75 a year. Then we passed the income tax law amendment in 1913, and 16 years later, it had gone from $6.75 to $29 per person a year. Now strap in your seatbelt and don't eject, because you can't. Today it's $5,700 a year per person. I hope I've made the point that when you've got a tax law that Congress can raise at will. See, it's the percent that's killing you, right? 40% of your paycheck now goes to taxes. Back in 1910, it was 10%. Now, and we know we're not getting our money's worth. Today we pay more in taxes to our nation than we pay for food, clothing, and shelter combined. Now, the new tax system's got to be fair, it's got to be paperless, it's got to raise the necessary revenues. I will not run up and down the streets of America promising you hope, opportunity, and growth, flat tax, flat tax, flat tax. If that is the best tax, that's the one we'll do. But we're going to look at all of them carefully, thoughtfully, and rationally. We're going to use the computer as our wind tunnel. We'll nail it, give it to you, and then move on to the next problem.
Ross Perot speaking to the Reform Party gathering here in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania last night. This is dangerous territory for Bill Clinton, Amy, because it kind of echoes, although it changes in emphasis, what Dole and Kemp were trying to get the American people to focus on at the Republican convention, which is a tax cut, the supposedly unfair tax system, the abolition of the IRS, and all those questions.
That's right, Larry. Well, I wanted to ask just about him being nominated to begin with, H. Ross Perot. Apparently, less than 5% of the Reform Party members, and they're defined quite loosely, many of them are just people who called into a 1-800 number to get a ballot, voted altogether.
Right. 49,266 people out of estimated 1.2 million, which is actually around 4%. I asked a lot of people, party officials as well as people in the crowd, about this. And the general answer I got was, well, it's a new procedure. Not everybody understood it. When you called the phone number, you got a 10-second long tone. If you didn't type in your PIN number on the telephone keyboard, you didn't get to vote. It's summertime. People are away. They didn't know the deadline for the mail. You know, a million different excuses. But nevertheless, a 4% turnout indicates to me that either the process was very messed up, and of course a lot of people didn't get ballots. We've heard about that, including former Colorado Governor Lamb, who had to call in and get one.
They said that he had written something in, but that his address was illegible.
His address was illegible. So now it's been published in the newspapers. I guess everybody in Colorado knows it anyway. But there's generally, people didn't seem to see that was a big obstacle to the party moving forward.
Although Lamb also was very bitter about the fact he could not get the list of members of the Reform Party and felt that the whole thing was rigged, so that what he said, one thank you to Perot, Perot mentioned him very briefly and a thank you to him, but clearly there was not a lot of good feeling between them.
Very little. And in fact, Lamb said on one of the Sunday morning chat shows yesterday on the networks that he's not yet decided who he's going to vote for in the fall.
Now, what about the vice presidential candidate? I was just reading the other day that Marcy Kaptur, the Democrat from Ohio, had turned Ross Perot down. Now, we know Marcy Kaptur as a leader in the anti-NAFTA fight in Congress.
Yes, and the other names that are being bandied about, I think, are also going to turn Ross Perot down. I could be wrong. Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia, who's retiring, seems to me to have much too big an ego to subsume it to Ross Perot's giant ego. And Senator Pete Domenici, who's now head of the Senate Budget Committee, seems unlikely he would turn down that job and quit the Senate to be Ross Perot's
vice president.
Since
he was one of the people in the video that introduced Bob Dole.
Right. So that's a name that's flying in the wind. He may come up with a surprise, Ross Perot. For example, yesterday, you were watching it, obviously, Amy, on C-SPAN or CNN. The person who introduced him, who did most of the speaking, was Meredith Bagby, who's a 20-something, 26-year-old, I believe, a recent graduate of Harvard who's about to go to law school, who does statistical analyses of the United States. And she was basically the MC of this entire TV show for Ross Perot. And that was quite a surprise. Choice to have a young woman that very few people in the country had heard of. There are and were here in, I should say, in Philadelphia and Valley Forge, more African Americans involved than I saw in Long Beach, although still only a tiny fraction of those present. But the issues that the reform people were talking about were many and varied, and I was impressed here, as I was in Long Beach as well, about the interest and concern and knowledge of public affairs that people have who are involved in this process. It may not always be accurate knowledge, but at least it's knowledge. One of the people who got exercised enough about what's going on in the United States to get involved in the Reform Party, rather, is Josephine Marchese of Denora, Pennsylvania, right outside of Scranton. And she says that she's quit her lifetime attachment to the Democratic Party because of trade issues.
NAFTA and GATT, that to me, that we lost too many jobs. There is no job security in my town. People are working at Burger King's, Wendy's. They're working on fixing cars. There's no manufacturing. The manufacturing is gone in our town. Scranton, Pennsylvania has a drug problem. We never had that before. We're in a mess in Lackawanna County.
And what do you attribute that mess to?
Poor government, poor policies that are destroying our job bases. We don't have good jobs.
And do you think Ross Perot can do anything about that, or is it the Reform Party that interests you?
The Reform Party, to me, if they mean what they say, reform, I think I would trust them more than I would trust Dole and Clinton.
Here in Pennsylvania, I found many more people who are, you might say, lapsed Democrats than in California, Amy, where most of the people I spoke to, in fact, all of them, were people who said that if they'd been political in the electoral system before, they'd been Republicans.
Larry, now that Ross Perot is moving on and he's going to be running in the race, couple things. Will he be included in the debates? And he is going to be taking federal matching funds, unlike last time.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. Somebody who has Ross Perot's record of rapacity, and we talked about this the other week with Mr. Posner, who wrote the book Citizen Perot, for him to turn down $30 million would be extremely uncharacteristic because he'd have to replace it with his own money. A lot of the corporate establishment media are now saying, well, it means he can only spend $50,000 of his own money if he takes the $30 million in federal money. That's not true. He can spend perhaps $30 million more of his own money in so-called party building, one of the many loopholes in the very soft campaign finance laws that we have. So he'll still be putting money into this thing, but he'll get a big chunk of taxpayer money as well. As far as the debates go, there are 11 criteria that a federal commission has as to who gets to participate in the debates. Perot's going to have to come up some in the polls before he qualifies. But there's a basic contradiction, I think, in many of the people who are here in Pennsylvania, were here yesterday at the meeting, and the whole idea of Perot supporters. And somebody who has been studying that is Mika Sifri, associate editor of The Nation magazine and also publisher of the Perot Quarterly. He says that a lot of people that he talks to inside the party aren't so sure about Perot, but they want to build a party. Others have the feelings the other way.
Well, there's a division between the real diehard followers who just, you know, who were holding up signs saying in Perot we trust and Ross is boss, and the other people who I think see the need more for a third party that would somehow force the other parties either to clean up their acts or replace one of them or to push some reforms. And they see Perot just as a vehicle. And in fact, there's an ongoing tension here. There is still a drive to force Perot to set up some kind of a structure apart from his personal campaign and apart from his personal staff that has not yet played itself out, and I still think that's really the question for this party, whether it'll ever be anything independent of Perot or just his own plaything.
Mika Sifri. So we'll find out the answer to that question as the campaign progresses. But again, looking back to Posner's book and our knowledge of Ross Perot, he is something of a consummate control freak, and it's hard to imagine him turning the party over to anyone but himself.
Well, Larry, thanks very much for joining us from Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, now in Philadelphia. I know you're going to be headed to Chicago later this week, as we all will be, and we'll be broadcasting live from the Chicago Democratic Convention all next week. And I should also say that tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll be playing Ralph Nader's speech. He's being nominated by the California Greens tonight, and he'll be giving his speech then. And finally, it's interesting to note the nominating convention of the Reform Party. They spent not very much money last night for that event. I think the Democrats and the Republicans can learn something from it. Together, they'll be spending, the Republicans and Democrats, somewhere between $50 and $70 million on their two conventions. Wouldn't just 2 hours each be nice, just as Ross Perot's event was all about last night? You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to talk about Martin Luther King and his name being invoked throughout the Republican convention. After that, we'll be looking south to the border. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman.
Bob and I are asking Americans to believe again in the promise of the American dream, to reach once more for the distant stars. We ask for your hands. We ask for your hearts and prayers. We want you to stand by us in this battle. And together, with God's help, we can achieve a better life for each and every American. Dr. King said, "I don't know what the future holds, but I do know who holds the future." God bless you. God bless America.
And that, of course, was Jack Kemp. He was accepting Bob Dole's offer to be his running mate on the Republican ticket. It was last week in Russell, Kansas. Well, if you've watched much of the Republican National Convention on television, you couldn't help but notice just how often the camera focused on the few African-American and Latino delegates who were in the overwhelmingly white audience. And if you listen to the speeches, you probably noticed that Martin Luther King was quoted again and again. But some would say Martin Luther King was misquoted or misappropriated. We're joined now by Eric Foner. He's professor of history at Columbia University and author of the book Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution. Yesterday, he had a letter to the editor in the Los Angeles Times, and I was surfing the net last night and found his piece on Martin Luther King and how his name has been invoked over the last year. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Foner.
Thank you.
Well, why don't you talk a little about how he's been used? I mean, clearly, Dr. King, for the first thing, has been used by the Republicans to say that he would have been against affirmative action if he was here today.
Well, the Republicans have a big problem with black votes, of course. I think when Clinton was elected, he got over 90% of the black vote. So obviously, Republicans are seeking to do what they can to increase the number of blacks voting for their candidates. And at the same time, of course, the Republican Party has become the cutting edge of the attack on affirmative action, which many black people see as a set of programs, governmental and private, which benefit them enormously. I think partly in order to appeal to blacks and partly to deflect the charge of racism or the charge that their attack on affirmative action is going to be detrimental to black Americans as well as others, there has been this tendency in the last few years for conservatives, Republicans of all kinds, to claim that they are really just doing what is in the tradition of Martin Luther King, that King believed in a colorblind society. That's the phrase. That's what the aim of the civil rights movement was, to make a colorblind society, and that therefore any federal policy or private policy that takes race into account, such as affirmative action, is really a violation of the heritage of the civil rights movement. This is a very clever ploy, but it ignores one basic fact, which is that King was in favor, strongly in favor of affirmative action at the time that he was alive, and wrote strongly about the need for it to compensate for past discrimination. But I think that there is a cynicism in the use of King, whereby one sentence from King is picked up again and again routinely, and that is the sentence from his speech at the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, where he says, I look forward to the day my children are judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. And this is taken to be the essential idea of Martin Luther King, and therefore anybody who looks at the color of someone's skin in any kind of policy is violating the legacy of King. I think King would be very surprised, and indeed more than surprised, quite unhappy with the way his legacy and his reputation has been invoked in order to justify turning back the clock on efforts to uplift the status of blacks in this society.
You know, I think it's interesting. In your piece that I found on the net in this new online magazine called Slate, you quote Dinesh D'Souza, who's in his book, The End of Racism. He says that he's following in King's footsteps, even though he advocates repealing the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Well, yes, D'Souza is a very good example of what I think, and perhaps the most extreme example, because D'Souza really knows nothing about American history and very little about race relations, but he wrote a long, rather insipid book about these issues. And D'Souza is a good example because he says the goal of the civil rights movement was to end color consciousness. That is, people should not be judged on the basis of race, which is fine. The question is, how do you get to such a society? What D'Souza says, and for D'Souza particularly, consciousness of color by government. When he says repeal the 1964 Civil Rights Act, what he says is private discrimination is okay. That's the law that bans discrimination by employers, public accommodations, businesses, etc. He said, no, that's not the goal of the civil rights movement was to end laws dealing like segregation laws, which discriminate against one group or another. Private acts of discrimination, the government law should not deal with. Now, of course, you know, that's absurd. Most of the discrimination in our history has been both governmental and private at the same time. And to say that an employer can discriminate against blacks and there's nothing wrong with that is to completely overturn the whole premise of the civil rights movement. But again, he invokes again and again King many times in that book, The End of Racism, claiming that what King's goal was color blindness. Now, if you go back through King or even the entire civil rights era, you will never find the phrase color blindness, or very, very rarely. The March on Washington, they weren't marching for color blindness. The slogan of that march was jobs and freedom. King always said the goal of the civil rights movement is freedom, substantive freedom for blacks, that they had been given nominal freedom 100 years before, and now they wanted that freedom to be substantive. And what he meant was blacks had to be fully brought into the mainstream of American life, in jobs, in education, in housing, in opportunity of all kinds. And to do that, King and many, many others, he wasn't the only one, understood that you had to take race into account in order to get to a society sometime in the future in which race didn't matter. To simply declare the society colorblind, to say, okay, everything is fine, there's no more racism, no more prejudice, and therefore we're going to ignore whether someone is black or white in dealing with them, is, you know, will take us backwards to the old days of allowing private discrimination rather than forwards to what King did want was eventually this society of color blindness.
You know, at the Republican convention, less than what was it, something like less than 3% of the delegates were African-American. And Bob Herbert in the New York Times today notes that a poll was done of the delegates and more than 60% of them were for repealing laws against racial discrimination.
Well, that's the yes. That's the, of course partly that's just the free market idea that that D'Souza and others, extreme rightists, claim that really the free market will prevent discrimination. In other words, if an employer is faced with the prospect of hiring a very qualified black person and an unqualified white person, if that employer hires the white person, his business is going to suffer. He's not going to be able to compete as much. In other words, he's injuring his own competitiveness by not taking the most qualified person. And therefore, employers like that will go out of business, so to speak, and the ones who hire the best person regardless of race will do the best. So the market takes care of it. Unfortunately, history, see, these guys either know nothing about or totally distort our history. Our history shows that for many, many years, for most of our history, in fact, even today in many ways, the market is perfectly comfortable with discrimination, and firms that discriminate, for example, by giving blacks lower wages than whites often do very well, and that increases their profits. The segmenting historically of blacks into low-paid, you know, low-wage, menial jobs increased profits, even though it deprived some employers of you know, of qualified people. So just to leave it to the market and to repeal laws about discrimination will completely take us back to the old days of rampant inequality in the society. But you know, I would like to see a poll of those delegates as to how many actually even knew a black person personally. You know, they come from suburbs, they come from segregated enclaves, walled in, you know, gated communities in the California suburbs. Well, they probably have blacks working in their homes as servants or something, but you know, they're dealing with these things as totally abstract issues with no real understanding of how real life operates.
Right. We mentioned this actually repeatedly last week, but 20% of the delegates, a fifth of the Republican delegates in San Diego, are millionaires.
Right. Well, I don't think too many of them. Yeah, there's not too many black millionaires in this country. There are a few, but not a heck of a lot.
Right. Well, we're talking to Eric Foner. He's a DeWitt Clinton professor of history at Columbia University. He's got an interesting piece on the internet called Stolen Dreams. And in it, you say that in King's book, Why We Can't Wait, published in 1963, as the movement to dismantle segregation reached its peak, King observed that many white supporters of civil rights recoil in horror from suggestions that blacks deserve not merely colorblind equality, but compensatory consideration. Can you talk a little about that, the idea of reparations, which I'm always amazed is not on the forefront of the civil rights movement today? I mean, Japanese Americans, while they didn't get a lot for being interned after World War II, it has been recognized that they are owed something and they're getting some compensation. Jews, of course, after Germany, have gotten some compensation. But what about African Americans today?
Well, that's a good question. This issue of reparations has been raised by certain black groups, but it's never really taken hold. Of course, the Japanese-American parallel is not perhaps precise, because there you have the only Japanese-Americans who are getting compensation in a fairly small amount, $20,000 each or something like that, were those people who were actually interned in these camps. In other words, just to be a Japanese-American does not entitle you to that kind of reparation. The question of Jews vis-a-vis Germany is perhaps more apropos. The State of Israel, for example, still gets payments from the West German government as a reparation for the Holocaust. Now, that goes to Jews or anyone in Israel. I could move to Israel tomorrow and I would benefit from those reparations, even though I have never, you know, I'm not a victim of the Holocaust, nor is my immediate family. But the Jewish people, so to speak, as a group, are getting a reparation because of the crime done to the Jewish people. And that's perhaps a more better analogy to the claim that the African Americans as a people have been done such injustice in this country that as a group they deserve this. But that's, I think, it's not, you know, I don't think King dwelled on this question of reparations for past evil in that direct sense. I think what he really was arguing was look, we have a society which was shaped by prejudice, shaped by discrimination for 300 years, slavery, segregation. And President Johnson said the same thing in his famous speech in 1965. To simply say, okay, we are stopping discriminating now, even if that were true, but we're going to leave intact all those structures which the gap in income, the gap in wealth, the gap in education and housing between black and white, which were created by all those hundreds of years of discrimination, to say, well, okay, we're going to leave that intact and now no longer discriminate, is not sufficient as a response to centuries of injustice. You'd, as you know, Johnson said, often quoted, you don't hobble a man for 300 years and then take the chain off and say, okay, go and race. You have to take into account the damage that has been done by the hundreds of years of discrimination and injustice. And that's really what he's talking about. How do you bring black people up into the mainstream of the society? You can't do that by acting as if the whole society is colorblind, and you can't take into account the fact that here is a group that has suffered a particularly, you know, extreme version of discrimination and prejudice. You've got to take that into account in order to move beyond it.
Professor Foner, throughout the convention, of course, Martin Luther King's name was invoked. And on Thursday night, the last night of the convention, after Bob Dole gave his speech and Jack Kemp gave his speech, over at one of the big hotels was a massive party, and it was called Solid South. And certainly that is what the Congress is today in terms of the leadership. You have Trent Lott, who's the majority leader of the Senate. You've got Newt Gingrich. He is the Speaker of the House. And under him, you've got Tom DeLay, Dick Armey, both from Texas. What about this Southern control of Congress?
We've also got a Southern president, of course, from a different
party. That's right, and Vice President Al Gore.
Yes, it is odd that 130 years after the Civil War, Southerners now seem to control the federal government at every level almost. But I think that, of course, the origins of this go back to the Civil Rights Movement and the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, which, and the Voting Rights Act of 65. When Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, he said, I am consigning the South to the Republican Party for the next generation, or perhaps more. That, in other words, blacks were getting the right to vote, but he was afraid that in reaction, white Southerners would shift over to the Republican Party in anger, and indeed that did and has happened in large measure. The problem is, and, you know, look, people have a right to vote for whatever party they want. The problem is that this strong Southern control goes hand in hand with the old Southern definition of states' rights and dismantling the federal government. Now, of course, states' rights is a long tradition in America, but it has, in so many cases, been associated first with the defense of slavery and then later with the defense of segregation. You don't hear a lot of blacks calling for states' rights because they know that traditionally the federal government has been the one to step in and override local prejudices and local elites and demand that everybody be treated equally in localities and states. If you leave things up to the states, again, our history shows local elites, the local powers, are going to run roughshod over the rights of minorities or, you know, dissenters, etc. You need a national standard of equality to be enforced by the federal government. So when many people, black and white, hear this cry for states' rights and dismantling the federal government, they see the specter of, state action to enforce inequality as has existed in much of our history. The federal government is not, is an instrument. Sometimes it's used very well, sometimes it's used very badly. But to simply say the federal government cannot interfere anymore in local affairs is to deprive those with less power at the local level of an instrument that they have used historically to try to achieve their rights.
You know, Noam Chomsky says that the reason that they want to give power to the states and take it away from the federal government is because the federal government is the only thing powerful enough to counter the corporations. And once you devolve power to the states, then you no longer can counter that kind of power.
Well, that has historically been the case, that it is large business interests have always been very, very nervous about federal power and have wanted to devolve power to the states. Although it's also true, of course, that for much of the 20th century, the large corporations have worked hand in hand with the federal government in promoting their own interests. I mean, the Clinton administration has probably done more for the large corporations than any administration in the 20th century. So one should not see the federal government and the big corporations as necessarily being enemies. But I think Chomsky's point is quite right. In a democracy, which we still are, although democracy seems to be somewhat tepid at the moment, given the way everything is just becoming, you know, infomercials on television like the Republican convention. But in a democracy, the power of the federal government is a power which is not immediately subject to the economic power of corporations. It is subject to popular voting power and can be and is up for grabs by many different groups, labor, minority groups, corporate groups, etc. These large corporations don't want to have another power source which is not always going to be necessarily controllable. And if you devolve, no state government can override the power of the large multinational corporations. The federal government has a lot of trouble doing that too, but at least it has more wherewithal to try to do that. So I think Chomsky's right that this is a source of democratic political power that that many people don't want to see continue to exist.
You know, we're also going to see the gratitude of those corporations to President Clinton next week at the Democratic Convention, as we saw at the Republican Convention, where they spend well beyond $10 million celebrating the parties. And it really doesn't matter if it's Republican or Democrat. As you say, they've benefited the most under the Democrats today.
Well, it is very unfortunate that, with the exception of Pat Buchanan, perhaps, in his own way, the issue of corporate power has disappeared from our political vocabulary lately. Back in the 1930s, 40s, even into the 1960s under Johnson and the Great Society, it was legitimate to discuss this as a political issue. Do the large corporations have too much power? What is the way of dealing with that? Today, neither party even mentions that. You know, it's just assumed that the business of America is business, as they say, or what's good for General Motors is good for the country, as an official of the Eisenhower administration said, and that is just not even open to debate. I mean, Ralph Nader and others, but they are not. I'm talking about people within the mainstream of the two major parties. That issue has been eliminated from our national life. But given the stagnation of wages and the great economic insecurity of many Americans, one would hope that issue may come back again into political life.
Well, Eric Foner, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Eric Foner is professor of history at Columbia University. He's got a piece on the internet on Slate, which is the online magazine of Michael Kinsley, who's left firing line and crossfire and gone off to Washington State to work for Microsoft. He's also got a letter in today's Los Angeles Times. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, we're going to be going south to the border, and we're also going to be looking at corporate control of the conventions. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. By holding their convention in San Diego, the GOP drew attention to the Mexican border and seized every opportunity to blast the Clinton administration's record on fighting illegal immigration. But Clinton has already done much to fortify the border. He doubled the number of Border Patrol agents and gave them state-of-the-art equipment. Just months after Operation Gatekeeper was in place, Border Patrol officials reported that the number of undocumented immigrants had abated by a third. But now Operation Gatekeeper is being called a fraud. Officials of the union that represents Border Patrol agents have charged that supervisors in the agency falsified arrest reports to make the program look like a success. Chris Richard of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles reports.
At the San Ysidro Frontier Crossing, Operation Gatekeeper is in full force. A helicopter patrols overhead, and on the ground every quarter mile, a green and white Border Patrol truck waits while agents inside scan the corrugated steel fence that separates Mexico from the United States. On the Mexican side, young men climb that fence or the concrete wall behind it, watching for an opening in the Border Patrol defenses. From their perches on the wall, they call back answers to a reporter's questions. This man says he passed over this way 4 years ago, and it was much easier because there were fewer agents keeping watch. This would-be border crasher says he's been trying to cross for a week. He won't give his name. He's afraid the Border Patrol agents parked a few yards away will pick it up on some high-tech equipment. But according to T.J. Bonner, president of the National Border Patrol Union, the imposing array on the frontier is a sham.
The orders came down from on high to change the report. Agents may not build rockets in their backyards in the weekend, but they're bright enough to pick up on the fact when you're being ordered to change something that you don't continually resubmit the reports that management doesn't want to see. So you get with the program.
Bonner says that program has nothing to do with catching more people. He says some 30 Border Patrol agents assigned to Operation Gatekeeper have complained of orders to ignore immigrants as they pass by. Other agents complain they're forbidden to record all the arrests they make. And Bonner claims Border Patrol authorities regularly bus immigrants out of the area covered by Operation Gatekeeper to make it appear that immigrant smugglers are moving east. Bonner says the motive is to make a failed policy look successful. He says it's the same attitude that made senior Border Patrol officials in Miami release scores of inmates, some with criminal records, from an overcrowded detention center before a June 1995 congressional fact-finding tour.
And the same thing happened over in San Diego. There was a congressional delegation that visited there. Nobody was in the detention area. They had taken Border Patrol vehicles that had no engines. They had towed them out to the border and placed them out there, brought in people on overtime to make it appear as though everything were under control. It just amazes me that they engage in such counterproductive deceptions.
Both the Border Patrol and the Justice Department's Office of the Inspector General are investigating these accusations. Since the probe is still underway, Border Patrol spokesman Ron Henley won't discuss the particulars of Bonner's allegations. But Henley says that the number of people apprehended on the western edge of the frontier has declined by one half in the last year. At the same time, he says arrests have gone up 30-fold in eastern San Diego County.
The premise behind Operation Gatekeeper was to move the traffic east, where the terrain is harsher, that only the hardy try it. You can't cross out in the mountains without a guide. And so the cost of smuggling goes up as well. So yes, it is working.
Reading from a prepared statement, Justice Department spokeswoman Anna Kobian stresses that any agent found to have falsified arrest figures will be severely punished. But she also defends the program's record.
Today, the progress is clear. New resources are shifting illegal traffic, toughening enforcement at the ports of entry, disrupting smuggling operations, and prosecuting a record number of illegal criminal aliens. Every local law enforcement agency has credited Operation Gatekeeper with having contributed to the reduction of crime in San Diego.
Bonner, the Border Patrol Union president, says the Justice Department has too much invested in Operation Gatekeeper to conduct a tough investigation. Officials from Attorney General Janet Reno to the local U.S. attorney have repeatedly praised the program, so Bonner wants to see an investigation from outside the Justice Department. He may get his wish. A California congressman, Republican Alton Gallegly, has called for a congressional hearing in September to look into the claims of systematic deception. For Democracy Now!, I'm Chris Richard in San Diego, California.
The Republican National Convention was swimming in liquid assets, and we expect no less of next week's Democratic Convention. The California Public Interest Research Group found that corporate sponsors of the GOP convention are also big-time patrons of candidates in California. Fernando Iglesias of CalPERG was at the convention to expose the money connections and to promote Proposition 212, the Anti-Corruption Act, one of two campaign finance initiatives on the November ballot in California.
What we found is that a lot of the major donors, corporate sponsors of the Republican convention, also are major political heavyweights in California. They contribute over $3 million in the last election cycle to candidates in California races. We thought that was interesting in the sense that it shows that the convention sponsorship is just another way that the same corporate influence peddlers are buying influence with elected officials. In California, we have a particular problem that corporate contributions are allowed, and they're allowed in an unlimited way. There's absolutely no limits in California.
Wait a second. Let me clarify this. You're saying that in contributing to the convention, there are no limits, or no limits on money you can give to, for example, congressional races?
Well, for the convention, there are supposed to be limits. It actually took lawyers for both parties about 20 years to pry open a loophole and make sure that they could actually give to conventions. It was a gray area in the law. The intent of the laws that were passed 20 years ago nationally was not to have any private money in this phase of a general election. But they've pried that open, and now you have actually more private money being used to fund the conventions than you actually have public money. So the public is paying for it through taxes, but they're also getting all the special interest money still coming in and buying influence. In California, we have absolutely no limits whatsoever on campaign contributions or spending, and there's no public financing or anything. There's a ballot initiative that our organization is sponsoring here in California. It'll be on the ballot for this November that would ban corporate contributions, and we think that it does a number of other things, but every reform has to start with banning direct corporate contributions, because that's where the really major money comes from. Philip Morris, for example, dipped right into its corporate treasury and gave $125,000 for one candidate who then went on to win his election the last election cycle by about 500 votes. Philip Morris, just $125,000 contribution they plunked down on one candidate.
Which candidate was that?
Same with Steve Kuykendall. He's a Republican candidate for the Assembly from the Long Beach area. His victory over a teacher who was actually running, was actually what tipped the scale in favor of the Republicans in California, the California Assembly. It was Republican by one vote, and that is that was the result of a $125,000 contribution directly from Philip Morris.
Was that contribution exposed during the campaign?
It came so late that it was not able to be used effectively. It came in the last, I believe it was 3 or 4 days of the campaign. It paid for a hard-hitting direct mail piece that was designed to turn off some voters and turn out other voters. And that's exactly the kind of thing you have when you have corporations allowed to contribute directly to candidates and directly to the political parties. So our initiative would ban that. It does a number of other things to control wealthy candidates running themselves, to control how much individuals could contribute to candidates down to $100, empower small grassroots contributors. A number of other things that need to be done, but the interesting thing and the connecting point to the conventions is that corporations that are sponsoring the political conventions here are the same corporations that are wielding influence at state legislatures and in Congress, and that their direct contributions need to be banned.
So let's talk about some of these corporations that are making those contributions, both to the Republicans and to the Democrats.
You have ARCO. The Atlantic Richfield Company at the top of the list, along with Texaco. Now, these are two oil companies that have been responsible in California for recently for the repeal of the electric car mandate. You might know that California is known for its smog problem, particularly Los Angeles area. It's a major health problem. The electric car is a program that was very widely supported in California to help clear up smog and reduce the amount of air pollutants. The Wilson-appointed Air Resources Board for California voted to rescind that mandate for the electric car just this spring under heavy pressure from the oil companies who are at the top of this list of corporate contributors. So that's some of the people you have underwriting the convention and also contributing to candidates in California. Philip Morris, example I mentioned, which had given $125,000 to this assembly candidate, enabling him to win in the last days of his election. You have other...
How much did Philip Morris give to this convention?
They gave... To this convention, I actually don't know. I don't believe those numbers are available yet. We know how much they gave to California candidates. They gave $511,000. To California candidates in the last election cycle, directly, just straight from the corporate treasuries. Now, this isn't even counting the individual executives who might band together to contribute. This isn't counting shareholders who might contribute. This is just straight from the Treasury, no hassles.
Or their families or their workers.
Other people who are associated with them. There's only 8 states that actually allow unlimited direct corporate contributions right now, which are the easiest avenue of influence. Clearly, though, in addition to banning corporate contributions, we need to limit individual contributions so the executives can't simply get together and pool large contributions and have influence that way.
Have some of these corporations responded to your study?
None of them have yet. We released it today. I imagine the response would be that, this isn't about buying influence, this is just about participating in the process. That's one of the mantras that's been put out recently by sort of corporate influence peddlers, is that they're not actually buying influence, it just so happens that these are the candidates whose views they agree with and they're expressing themselves. And the problem, of course, is that average citizens who can't express themselves with $511,000 and influence policy in the same way.
So is there anything you'd like to add about this report that you have released this week?
The major point is that the corporate sponsors of political conventions are sponsoring them for the same reasons that they contribute money to candidates directly, which is to buy influence over the opinion leaders who are there. And we feel that a lot of people are offended by the commercialism of the Olympics, and that you could argue that, like the Olympics, this is our democracy. Another ancient Greek tradition that we have is debased by corporate sponsorship. It is perverted and is something that something we really shouldn't have. We should have contributions coming from a broad spectrum of citizens and amounts that the average person could afford, not from the large economic institutions that have a tremendous amount of power in this country. The point of the original law was to have them, have the public money replace the private money in these conventions, and what we now have is both. We have large corporate contributions and the public money, and the public's getting hit twice with that.
Fernando Greges is with California Public Interest Research Group, known as CalPERG. He was at the convention last week exposing the money connections. And CalPERG is promoting Proposition 212, the Anti-Corruption Act, one of the 2 campaign finance initiatives on the November ballot in California. By the way, since the Democratic and Republican conventions together will be spending something like more than $70 million on their 2 conventions, we're wondering if you have a better idea of how that money could be used. Why don't you call our comment line at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313.
The path of least resistance, or when I'm seeking some relief, I might do anything for money, and still don't got me none, but at least I ain't a Republican, at least I ain't a Republican. Well, I might call in sick to work and then go out and play. I might roll the dice and lose all night and cheat at cards all day. Well, I might curse the darkness and then damn the rising sun. But at least I ain't a Republican. Television with a big old baseball bat.
Ain't No Republican by the Rootless Cosmopolitans. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, engineered by Kenneth Mason here at the studios of WPFW in Washington, D.C. Thanks to Audrey Bentham at WHYY in Philadelphia and Bernard White at WBAI in New York. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us by email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!